Hello, I'm Preston Schlankover. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. What does that mean? In a nutshell, it is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you and your community. This week's show is brought to you by doTERRA's On Guard Beadlets and On Guard Plus Protective Soft Gels. On Guard is a great way to strengthen and maintain a healthy immune system. This is why they are my family's daily regimen, especially during these colder months where there's a lot more chance of getting sick. The beadlets are 1/4 drop of the blended essential oils that makes this so effective at doing its job. I carry a tube in my pocket for on-the-go use. The proprietary blends of oils in On Guard Plus soft gels have a great On Guard formula plus some extra oils for an added kick to boost your immune system. For more information, visit our website at www.oilsforlifetoday.com. That's oils, number 4, lifetoday.com. Or go to the show notes and click on the link that's at the bottom. Now let's get on with our show. This week's episode is about the Yellowstone Caldera supervolcano. And we have our good friend and guest host, Drew Bombeck, with us. He's an emergency manager, and he is very up to date on things like this. As most of you know who have been listening to some of the prior shows, he is a wealth of information. So welcome back, Drew.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Preston.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. I tell you, I was telling my wife earlier that I always learn something new. You know, this is very informative, all the shows that we've done so far together. And, you know, going in, learning new things, even though I know a lot about Yellowstone because I've studied it a little bit. Plus, I listened to an audio book about it. It was a Bobby Eckhart. He's a fiction writer, but he takes a lot of pride in his research and talks to geologists and volcanologists and everything to get everything right. And his story on the Yellowstone Caldera is fantastic. I think it's 5 books or 6 books long, and it was really good and informative. It gives you an idea of the magnitude of what Yellowstone can be.
Yeah, it has the potential to be a massive incident, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now, I found a couple articles, one by the National Park Service, which has a lot of great information, and links are going to be in the show notes for anybody who wants to go and look. But one of them that I found is from Vox, V-O-X. It's a online news site, and they actually did a really good article, and it's quite lengthy, and they use a lot of the USGS photographs and charts and stuff, and we'll probably talk about one of the maps a little later. But they open up this article entitled "What Would Happen If Yellowstone Supervolcano Actually Erupted?" And they start off with, "If the supervolcano underneath Yellowstone National Park ever had another massive eruption, it could spew ash for thousands of miles across the United States, damaging buildings, smothering crops, and shutting down power plants. It'd be a huge disaster. But that doesn't mean we should all start freaking out. The odds of that happening are, thankfully, pretty low. The Yellowstone supervolcano, thousands of times more powerful than a regular volcano, has had only 3 truly enormous eruptions in history." And there's some diagrams that show the size of what the Yellowstone supervolcano could be compared to the pea-sized Mount St. Helens eruption. Mm-hmm. So yep. I'll pass it over to you and let you give us a little more insight into what this the supervolcano at Yellowstone, the super caldera, the potential of it is, and what kind of history we've got with it.
Yeah, and you know, we certainly do have a history with Yellowstone, and you know, nowadays people are more cognizant of it, but up until recently, even scientists didn't really realize that Yellowstone was a volcano, because when you think of a volcano, you think of Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier, you think of the standard shield cone volcano, and where's the mountain? Where's the smoking top? Well, we don't have that at Yellowstone. What we have at Yellowstone is, as you named it, it's a caldera. In other words, there have been super eruptions at Yellowstone before. And when the magma chamber actually blows, it blows through the crust of the Earth, and it vents so quickly that all the land on top of the magma chamber just kind of collapses partially down into the chamber. Then you're left with this giant caldera or cauldron, this giant depression in the Earth that is, you know, somewhere around 34 miles by 55 miles. And most of the Yellowstone National Park sits in that caldera. And the beauty of Yellowstone, all the geysers and the hot springs, all of that is because of this magma chamber, this upwelling of magma underneath the park from the Yellowstone hotspot. And, you know, there have been, as I said, there have been three super eruptions in the past at Yellowstone. There's the most recent was somewhere between 630,000 to 640,000 years ago. The next one before that was about 1.3 million years ago. And the one before that was about 2.1 million years ago. And so there's, unfortunately, we don't know, we can't say, well, it erupts on average every, you know, well, if you do the numbers, there have been three in the last 2.1 million years. If you do it by average, well, it should erupt every 700,000 years. Well, since the last one was 640,000 years ago, well, we have 60,000 years before we have a super eruption. But unfortunately, Yellowstone is irregular in its eruptions. So what that means is that super eruptions in Yellowstone are neither regular nor predictable. So we're currently, scientists say that intervals of a reoccurrence are every 600 to 800,000 years. Okay. And now if you look back over time before the Huckleberry Ridge eruption, which is the one 2.1 million years ago, what we currently call the Yellowstone hotspot has been around for about 18 million years. And it appears, if you're looking at it from up above on the North American tectonic plate, that it kind of moves to the east, northeast, but in reality, it's stationary and the North American plate moves over it. And there have been about 12 super eruptions over this hotspot's history. And only the last three have been in the Yellowstone Basin area. The others have been, you know, the Nevada-Oregon border. They created the Snake River Plain, things like that. So maybe if we look back over that 18 million year time period, we can then judge a little more of, well, can we figure out how frequently it erupts? But even then, it's not totally accurate because as the North American plate moves, well, the difference in density and thickness of the plate has an effect on whether this thing actually goes off in a super eruption.
Yeah, the amount of Earth that would be displaced, it's so much that this article by Vox has a map that looks like a bullseye chart that shows where the prevailing winds would blow the Earth and, you know, all the ash from this eruption, and it effectively covers all of the 48 states and Canada and some parts of northern Mexico.
Absolutely, yeah, you're quite right. This is, I think the diagram, it's from a USGS article, and I want to say, I can't remember the exact year, but I want to say it's like the 2014-2015 article they did,
right,
projecting the ash fall. And, you know, one significant thing to note is that obviously it's a projection based on what we know now. So, and of course, depending on if a super eruption were to happen right now, you know, today, the ash distribution might be different from these projections, and actually probably would be different from these projections. But something else to think about is when our listeners look at this particular map, it's very worth noting that in some areas, like in the far, you know, the East Coast or the far Southeast, you might find that Florida doesn't get any ash fall, or that, you know, Washington, D.C. gets more than 1 to 3 millimeters of ash fall. But if you know, when folks look at this diagram, it's worth noting that closer in to the volcano itself, to the super eruption itself, you're going to have that massive amount of ash fall, that, you know, 100, 200, 500 to 1,000 millimeters of ash fall. And, you know, for folks who think that they're going to hide out in what has become known as the American Redoubt up there in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, well, when this thing goes off, that place is toast. So you might want to relocate somewhere else.
Yeah, you're looking at getting buried in ash all the way to Calgary.
Exactly.
Looks like most of eastern, all the way through central Oregon and Washington State is covered in the pinkish color, which is 30 to 100 millimeters of ash fall. So that's pretty dynamic. And then 10 to 30 exactly. millimeters of ash fall all the way to Portland and Seattle. So it would be a catastrophic event.
It would be. Yeah,
America would cease to be the power that we are, because the devastation that would happen is beyond bringing anything back. Because, you know, that much ash
absolutely.
Falling, you're not going to be able to grow anything for quite a while.
Well, and you know what people don't also often fail to realize about this is about volcanic ash in general. Is when we say ash, I mean, when somebody hears the word ash, they think of ash from a fireplace or burning paper or, you know, a cigarette or a cigar or something like that.
Or the campfire. It's different.
Exactly. That stuff crumbles and people are like, okay, big deal. Well, volcanic ash isn't like that. Volcanic ash is microscopic bits of dirt and rock. And if you look at it under an electron microscope, it's the edges are incredibly sharp. And essentially, it's dry concrete that has been turned into a small powder and blasted in the air. And you mentioned that Yellowstone is going to have a tremendous amount of ejecta. And you're right. If we have another super eruption there, it will be what's known as a VEI, or Volcanic Explosivity Index. It'd be a VEI 8, which is the strongest kind of eruption you can have. And that's what super eruptions are. And it would be defined by a VEI 8 has 1,000 or more cubic kilometers of tephra, of dirt and rock and magma, that's blown up into the atmosphere. And so, as a matter of fact, the earliest Yellowstone super eruption, the Huckleberry Ridge one, 2.1 million years ago, was 2,500 times larger than the Mount St. Helens eruption. The Mount St. Helens eruption was a VEI 5, which means it had 1 cubic kilometer of ejecta, of ash blown into the atmosphere. So Huckleberry Ridge blew 2,500 cubic kilometers of ash and magma and dirt and all that junk into the atmosphere, which is a massive amount. And, you know, you mentioned the damage that this would do to the United States, to North America. And it wouldn't just end there, though, because for one thing, the U.S. really is, possible exception of some of the South American states like Argentina and Brazil and Australia and New Zealand, the U.S. really is the world's breadbasket. We produce a lot of the grains, particularly, that gets exported around the world. And if we don't produce that, the rest of the world doesn't have it. But there's something even worse. You mentioned when you were in the Army and St. Helens went off, you had ash fall in Frankfurt.
Yeah, we had very fine dusting on our vehicles. It was strange. And then my mom sent me a baggie with some dust in it, you know, because, you know, I grew up in Portland, and so she just scooped it up and sent it to me. But
yep.
you know, they got a pretty good dusting, and they survived. There were probably some vehicles that got messed up because of the fine dust. But, you know, it's one of those things that it's very hazardous to try and operate in those, an environment like that, with that fine dust that, you know, you breathe it in and it is coats your lungs and turns into concrete and you can't breathe.
Exactly. Yeah. If you're in a heavy concentration of volcanic ash, you've got it totally right. If somebody inhales that, it mixes with the fluid in their lungs and it turns into concrete, and people literally drown in concrete the equivalent thereof. And like you said, after Mount St. Helens, there were some vehicles that were damaged, but think about when we had Mount Redoubt in Alaska go off within the last, 10 years. Think about when we had the Icelandic volcanoes go off, how they had to reroute jet traffic.
Yeah.
Around them and really close some airways, because this dust, this volcanic ash, like I said, you know, it's pulverized rock. It gets into an engine, a jet engine, a car engine. It gets into an air conditioner. It will tear things up. And, you know, something else to think about, not only with the American breadbasket getting wiped out and the damage that this ash can do to vehicles around the world as the ash spreads. You know, back in the 70s, the 80s, the early 90s, when we still had the two superpowers, we had the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and we had the Cold War, and we talked about the concept of nuclear winter after a large-scale nuclear exchange. Something like Yellowstone will produce what's known as a volcanic winter, because this magma chamber, the magma chamber that is the Yellowstone hotspot, it's about 80 kilometers or 50 miles long by about 40 kilometers or 24 miles wide, and it's about 8 kilometers deep. So, and this thing is not completely filled with liquid magma. It's, you know, part of it is melt, part of it is solid rock that's still really hot, and some of it is on the verge of melting. Some of it's more solid, but this magma has a massive amount of gas dissolved in it, like sulfur-based gases and other gases. And it's kind of like a giant soda can or a soda bottle, and it's, you know, these carbonated drinks, they have carbon dioxide dissolved in them. And when you look at it, until you open it, it doesn't look like anything. But then if you relieve the pressure, the gas starts coming out of solution and it expands. And as it expands, it causes the liquid, in this case, the magma, to expand. And because it's under so much pressure in the chamber, but if you have some kind of geological process that releases enough pressure, you know, the gases start bubbling out of the magma. The magma expands in volume. And if enough gas comes out of solution quickly enough, it can cause a chain reaction of gas coming out and magma expanding. And if this then leads to added pressure relief, you know, like blowing crust material off the top of the chamber, then you vent the magma chamber into the atmosphere and you have essentially a super eruption. Not only do you have the ash, the lower lying ash that falls out of the atmosphere relatively quickly, you have even finer ash that goes up into the upper atmosphere along with gases like hydrogen sulfide and, you know, sulfur dioxide. And these gases and this really fine ash in the upper atmosphere, as the sunlight comes in, it hits these, and the more stuff is in the upper atmosphere, it reflects the sunlight back out in space and reducing surface heating.
So you've got a heavy winter just from the ash that's going around in the stratosphere.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting to note, back in 1815, Mount Tambora, which is in what's present-day Indonesia, then was the Dutch East Indies, Mount Tambora erupted, and it was a VEI 7. So it had 100 cubic kilometers of ejecta. And in 1816, the world experienced what we refer to as the year without a summer, because the ash and gases ejected into the upper atmosphere led to a global temperature reduction of between 0.4 to 0.7 degrees Celsius, or almost 0.75 degrees to 1.75 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm. And this directly led to weather and to the year without a summer, which was a global agricultural disaster caused by the combination of massive amounts of severe weather and decreased temperatures that can be traced back to that eruption. And if we look back further in the geological record, 74,000 years ago, one of the most recent super eruptions in geological history happened, and that was Mount Toba, again in Southeast Asia.
Still on the Pacific Rim.
Still on the Pacific Rim. It was a VEI-8. The geologic record and the research that they pulled up from ice cores and whatnot indicate that there was a volcanic winter that lasted from 6 to 10 years.
Mm.
So significantly decreased temperatures for 6 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of extinctions that went along with that, or a lot of species that got almost wiped out. Basically, you're talking 3 to 4 degrees, maybe even a little more temperature reduction globally for 6 to 10 years. And think of what that does to agriculture. If we have that from Yellowstone, and then for up to 1,000 years after Toba went, there was still lower than normal temperatures. So volcanic winter would be a significant issue following Yellowstone.
Yeah. Now, you know, we're talking about worst case scenario here with the whole thing going as what has been modeled by the USGS and the Park Service. But it could be smaller, and it could have
absolutely.
It could still have some devastation based on the size of whatever eruption it has, because there's actually three different places in the caldera that have gone off before. And there's two domes there that they could go, you know, there's just so many options that are there that, you know, you can't really plan for all of them. But this here would be an extinction level event if this thing went off, pretty much. I mean, it'd take out a lot of people. But for a smaller eruption, something like the one in that happened 1.3 million years ago in the second caldera there. If that went, you know, what kind of planning and preparing can somebody do for something? You know, downwind for the most part. You know, if you're next to it, if you're in the park, you better have fire insurance. But
yeah, and you know, you've got a good point, and we have been discussing worst case. I think if you were to talk about any kind of caldera forming event from the Yellowstone hotspot, it's going to end up being worst case. I mean, it may not be as bad as Huckleberry Ridge, but even that, the 1.3 million years ago, it was a caldera forming, so it was a super eruption.
Right.
It was over 1,000 cubic kilometers of ejecta. But you've got a great point. Yellowstone isn't just VEI-8 super eruptions with 1,000 cubic kilometers of ejecta. It has, I mean, look back in the 1950s. In the mid-50s, you had the Hebgen Lake earthquake, which was, I want to say, God, I can't remember. I want to say it was like a 7.6, and it caused a tsunami on Hebgen Lake in Yellowstone, in the park.
Wow.
And you know, we look at Yellowstone, and there are some people who are like, all they focus on is worst case, and oh my God, this is going to go off, and I have to be prepared for this. Well, you've got a point. It's, unless you're at the very fringes of the U.S. In the Southeast, you're probably not going to be able to do anything that's going to prepare you for that. But if you're closer in, there's always the possibility of a significant earthquake there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all the earthquake preparedness that you have anywhere else goes. There's also the possibility of, instead of having a gray eruption like a super eruption where, you know, it just blows massive amounts of stuff into the air, you have the possibility of more of a red eruption where you have lava coming out, because Yellowstone has had those in the past as well.
Right, yeah.
The other concern you have with Yellowstone is you have the concern of hydrothermal events where, and this is what this is what makes Yellowstone so beautiful, is the hydrothermal features, where water gets down deep and it gets heated by the heat of the magma chamber and it comes up as a geyser or as a hot springs or whatever. Sometimes you have hydrothermal explosions and you have hydrothermal eruptions where, you know, something will blow up, and usually it's not, you know, it's not going to be even, it doesn't even approach a VEI index, really. It sure as heck isn't Mount St. Helens, but you have the potential for somewhere in between a VEI 0 and a VEI 8. You could have some kind of eruption that is more locally devastating and, you know, regionally has some effects. And the standard precautions really apply there. Keep in tune with YVO, the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, the USGS operates, because they monitor ground uplift. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things they monitor extensively is ground uplift in the basin, in the Yellowstone Basin. And they were really concerned about it for a while, because back in the early 2000s, the early part of last decade, between I think 04 and 08, it was, the ground uplift was around 3 inches a year, which is more than three times what we usually see, although, and that indicated some changes in the magma chamber. That slowed now.
Well, they monitor that activity there on a regular basis, because it's mm-hmm. it is a threat, and they want to make sure that they have the ability to warn people, those who live in the area and those who are visiting, because they have a, you know, year round visitors there.
Exactly.
But we're going to have to cut it right there. And I want to thank you for being our guest host and giving us this great information about Yellowstone and the caldera and everything. Wish we had more time. Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. And be sure to check out our Facebook page at Civil Defense Radio and our Twitter page at civil_def_radio, where we post information about the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. I want to thank Drew again for being with us and giving us such great information. And I want to thank you, our friends and listeners out there who are with us on a regular basis. I really appreciate you guys being with us this week. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.